We decided last week that this week we would go straight to Ramanuja and discuss his views on Vedanta, directly commenting on Shankaracharya. He's not a contemporary of Shankaracharya, who lived from 788 to about 820. Rather, he comes about 250 years later. And where Shankara lived a mere 32 years, Ramanuja lived 80. The contrast is sharp between these two great thinkers. And it's based in part on spiritual experience, and it's based also on the outlook of the world, how we gather what is real and what is not real. So we've seen various world models to this point. We've seen the Vedic model, where the divine himself, as Prajapati, is divided in being, and himself becomes the corporal body of the world, its inner self, and all things that exist within it are part of his self-sacrificed being. The gods, the cosmic functionaries, do the duty of slicing this great immensity up, this person, as part of the sacrifice that brings the world into being. And then the world thereafter is always trying, in a sense, to restore that unity, to gather back that harmony of oneness that Prajapati was in the beginning. So it's an interesting suggestion that lies there about the world in its rounds of development, always trying to restore this sense of unity. And that's what the sacrifice is about when we pour an oblation on the mystic fire. And it is carried upwards to heaven. We are, through that act, uniting matter and spirit, making things whole again. So the Vedic period was not one in which philosophy was really done, but it considered the world to be fundamentally real, to be enjoyable, and that our business here is to live fully, to live 100 years, reveling in the rapture, in the words of the Veda. That is a view that is familiar to us. We've read and studied the Vedas together several times, and it's carried over into the Upanishads with different language. There, the Upanishads, which become a little more philosophic, become a little more psychological, begin to describe reality as being unified, that it is the great breath of being that, in a sense, gives force and expansive power to what becomes the cosmos, and that is called Brahman. From Brh, B-R, with a dot under it, H, that which grows, that which expands. So this is a reality which is not silent and static, but in the Upanishads it is dynamic and moving. And this great reality is found in us as well. We who subjectively view the world from our poises of selfhood are seeing what is real. The world is real. The self is real, and in fact the core of the world is the same as the core of the self. Atman is Brahman. There is no difference. And then when you're seated in that consciousness, you're not thinking about it, but you're actually seeing it, then the world becomes harmonious and extremely delightful. So the Brihadaranyaka, the Taittiriya, talk about these paths of bliss, that the full realization of the divine leads you to great bliss. And then one who achieves finally courses through the worlds freely. He's not captured by the experience of the senses anymore. He's not captured by the confinements of the ego any longer. No, he is a spirit that is sporting in a world that has been built for the enjoyment of the divine. And when you realize, recover your oneness with the divine, then you, in a sense, become a co-creator with that divine and course through the worlds happily. Well, we saw that when we got to Buddhism, there's a completely different view, that not accepting the Vedic or the Vedantic teachings, coming from their own free view of the world, the Buddha, and in kinship with him, Jainism, saw the world as a place primarily of suffering. That one suffers because one grasps. One reaches for what one cannot have. One thinks one is what one is not. And to quit this world of suffering is all the business of the seeker. Not to try to reconcile, not to try to talk about God. Buddha will not engage with you in that discussion, whether there is or is not a God. Get out of the suffering. And there's a way to do that. And he shows through his graduated path how one can lift one's consciousness out of thraldom to the ego and arrive at the blowing out of the fiction. He doesn't say that there is no consciousness afterwards. Since nirvana is described as the state of great supreme happiness, some experience must be there for the one who is liberated, but he won't say who that liberated one is or what that state is. Leaves it undescribed. And really it is ineffable, isn't it? We can't know. We can't speak what that is. We can't know it as an object. We can't learn it in a lesson book. We have to experience it. And if we experience it, then this thing that we, this baggage of skin, this collection of bones, this youth maturing, decaying in age, is not interesting any longer. It is that something that is behind it. What the Kena Upanishad says is that ah moment. That is like what Buddha is expressing. But no doubt about it, he views the world as being a field of suffering, a samsara from which we cannot escape. Yes, there is rebirth. And we are born again and again and again. But what is this thing? It is that fiction that is born, and that fiction leads us further to friction, leads us further into suffering, so we must give that up. And by the by, we were speaking that this idea of rebirth goes all the way back to the Rig Veda. It is there in the Rig Veda. So, we have the Vedic and the Vedantic view of the world, of the soul in the world, being one with Brahman and the world being an expression of Brahman. We have the Buddha saying, what self? If I carved open your chest and reached inside, would I pull out a self? What is this world of great delight where everybody is suffering and people starve and there is, need we describe it? No. But Shankara comes and says, I'll go one better than Buddha. This is not a world of suffering. This is not a world at all. Because he begins with the asseveration of the Vedanta that Brahman is the sole reality. He takes that as his basis. And it is a positive reality, not a negative. Nirvana could be described by philosophers as non-being or some such thing. But to Shankara, Brahman is. It is a positive state of being. But it is singular. It is undivided. Because if it is real, then there can't be some other reality. There can only be one reality. If there is only one reality, division can't really exist. If division doesn't exist, then this multi-part universe cannot exist. So how do we think it's there? And he says, because we perceive it wrongly. We see one thing and mistake it for another. Because we're enmeshed in senses, because we're enmeshed in mind, etc., we think that there is a world out there. We walk along a dark road and we see a rope. We think it's a snake and we fear. But actually, that snake is not there. It simply is a rope. And so we mistake the unity of Brahman as a multiform universe. It is not. So, if through listening to sages and studying closely scriptures and analyzing our experiences and contemplating deeply, vichara, we can have an experience that leads us away from the attraction of the senses into the unpartite experience of Brahman. And as soon as we wake up to that, we are free and we can live as a jivanmukta. So for Shankara, the state of jivanmukta can occur while this body is here or seems to be here. Because the consciousness is the only thing that is real in our experience. The consciousness of ourself, if we follow it back and back and back, will lead us into the experience of reality, and we will find there that Atman and Brahman are not different. So, his is a position of advaita, not to non-dualism. It's not a position of monism. It is saying that there are not two. There's only one real. And if you accept that as real, as the Vedas and Upanishads say it must be, then this is the inescapable conclusion to that. We also noted last week that Shankara likely was a devotee of Shiva, that he accepted that as long as one is in the body, one has to comport oneself with dharma, with the rules and regulations and the proper direction of life. And if you have to worship God as a convenient temporary idol that later you will dispose with, then so be it. You can think that there's a personal God, but ultimately you'll be led to the experience where you pour yourself into the oceanic vastness of Brahman, and all distinction between you and another, between a soul and a God, is gone. So that is Shankara's position. Ramanuja, a couple of hundred years later, shows his brilliance as a youth and is devoted to Vishnu. But his first teacher, Yadavacharya, is either a Shaivite or an absolute Vedantist. Adwaitin. And so he is always mocking those who believe in God. And of course, Vishnu is a personal God, the one who is vast, who makes the three strides. The universe comes out of his navel as it might out of the womb of a mother. So Ramanuja is always at odds with his teacher, with his guru. And I'm going to skip most of the long story of his life, although it's fascinating. And finally, it's unclear whether his teacher or the teacher's disciples decided to try to spring a trap upon him, ambush him, and kill him. But he got wind of it and made his escape and found his way to another village in South India. He had heard about Yamuna, but by the time he actually got there, Yamuna had passed away. But he had just died, and the top three fingers of his hand were curled in. And the disciples there recognized this young man at once as being a great devotee and as who would be the best student of Yamuna, and said, "We think that what these curled fingers mean is that first you must come and write the Bhashya, the commentary on the Brahma Sutras, and set Shankara right." And there were two other things too. And as soon as the young boy said, "Yes, I will do it," and took the vow, the fingers straightened. And they could do the necessary obsequies. And so he becomes the disciple of Mahapurna, who was himself the disciple of the recently deceased teacher. And he teaches this thirsty lad everything that he knows, and he says, "I've taught you my very best." Now, another village nearby, there's a man named Goshti Purna. He is an incarnation of knowledge, and you must go and study with him. So the boy goes there and makes his presentation. The guru refuses to see him. Other people in the village, wise people, priests, come back and say, "You cannot refuse him. This is the one to whom you must give that great mantra that you have." He refuses to listen. 18 times this young man comes and presents himself to the guru. And he refuses ever to give him an audience. So, devastated, he goes and he sits and he weeps, because he thinks there must be some profound imperfection in him that prevents him from having the august darshan of this great teacher. The people come and tell the teacher, Goshti Purna, what is happening. And he's moved. And he sends his disciples and says, "Bring the boy to me." So he comes and he says, "I recognize you're the one I'm going to give this teaching to. I'm going to give you the greatest mantra of them all. And I want you to understand that it will liberate anyone who hears it. I'm giving it to you only, and so you must keep it to yourself and never tell anyone." So the boy makes the promise, and he meditates on the mantra that is given and quickly realizes the divine and sees only Vishnu wherever he looks, beyond the world, throughout the world, in every soul. And it is wonderful, and it is as if he is living in Vaikuntha itself. And he is beaming with happiness, and he's walking back to his village. And suddenly he gets this idea. He turns around, and he goes back, and he climbs to the top of the biggest wall that he can find at the temple. And as he's walking, he's telling people, I have a priceless jewel. Come with me to the temple and I'll give it to you. And so there is a crowd building. And everybody is coming thinking they're going to get wealth. And when they get there, he climbs up and he says, I'm going to tell you the mantra that will liberate you. Anyone who hears this mantra and learns to say it will be liberated after the death of the body. You will have moksha. And so he calls out the mantra. And he says, now repeat it. And they repeated it. And so they did this three times. And to see the faces, they were all in deep joy, tears running down their faces because they had the promise of liberation. And it was as if Vaikuntha had come to earth that day. So, the teacher hears the ruckus, steps out, and is informed of what's happened, and he's very angry. And he goes storming up to the young man who is coming to approach him to kneel at his feet and make pranam. And he says, how dare you come back into my sight? You vile thing. Off with you. Go from here. I never want to see you again. And surely, hell is too good a place for you. And the boy folds his hand and says, I know that I have broken my promise, but you told me that this mantra would liberate anyone who heard it. And I knew that if I said what I had learned, that I would go to hell. But I thought of the thousands and thousands who would go to heaven. If only I would go to hell. And I thought I should tell them. And so, mine is hell, but theirs will be Vaikuntha. And the teacher looked at him and said, you are my teacher. You are my guru, because you are the very heart of Vishnu. You are so vast in your being that I now make supplication to you. I shall become your disciple. And Ramanuja said, you are my teacher eternally. You are my eternal guru. You are my sadguru. And it is only because you had attained that mantra and given it to me, who am nothing, that I am able to transfer that goodness to others. And so, what a disciple. What a teacher. But what a disciple. So this is Ramanuja. A deep lover of Vishnu, and he could not abide the idea that the communion that a soul could feel with God would be illusory. He said, no, it is not so. So the worldview that he posits, as opposed to Shankara's, is that, yes, there is a fundamental reality, the divine. You call it Brahman. That's what the Brahma Sutras call it. We call it Brahman. It is Vishnu. But that is the only reality. The world, too, is real, but it is not independently real. It must inhere in its reality upon Brahman. And just as a man wears a coat, so does Brahman wear the world. The coat is real so long as it's on the man's body. But if it were to be deprived of the man, it would have no existence. It would fall away. Just so is the world. And the soul is real. The soul, the jiva, is always in existence, but in existence by connection to the divine. It too inheres on the divine's reality. So Brahman is real. The world is real. The self is real. So it is a realistic philosophy. And it affirms the many. It affirms the plurality of the jivas. But they are not divorced from God. And in their communion with God, they are not annihilated. Yet another difference from Shankara. Because as a drop of water might enter an ocean and disappear in that ocean, so might a soul entering Brahman disappear. To Ramanuja, that is unimaginable. Because the jiva, the core essence, is Atman and is one with that, and so cannot, by dint of its immortality, of its eternity, pass out of existence, but must always be. But it always is in Brahman, depending upon that reality, which is primary. So the first order of reality is Brahman. And that Ishvara then posits a world from his own being, which he sustains. And the many souls that occupy that world can occupy him also. They are not bound to the littleness of being a rock, being a squirrel, being a man, being a god. They can recover their spiritual essence by casting off what deludes them, what blinds them to that, and recover their unity with the divine. But, and you probably heard this in that connotation, it is not possible, say these philosophers, to attain complete moksha while in the body. So for them, the idea of jiva mukti is not possible. You can become greatly enlightened, but it is not available to you to attain moksha until the body is cast off. So losing the body is the doorway to liberation to these thinkers. It is a very interesting argument that Ramanuja makes. It is linguistic rather than logical. And what is interesting about it is that it squares with our experience of things. Because how many spiritual seekers have been able to affirm from the bedrock of their own souls that Brahman is the sole reality. But I feel deeply in communion with that. That is real, and I feel my reality in that. And yet here I am, still living and breathing in the world. But the world has changed to me, having moved into this new consciousness. It is not the same world anymore. It is no longer a world of suffering and strife. Yes, there is pain, but the psychology in the being does not interpret it as suffering any longer. Rather, there are graduated experiences of delight, of bliss, so we can move towards a supreme delight. What is available to us in the body may be greatened even after we leave it, according to this perspective. I would say that all delight is available here in this body. Yes. Why not? The total reality is always with us. It is nowhere else. It is not up there. It is inside you. Everything that is in the universe and beyond the universe is already in you. You don't have to seek for it anywhere else. I'm wandering, though. So, this is the view of Vishishtadvaita, what they call qualified non-dualism. Because what is qualified is the real being. It never changes. The qualities may change. Another point. The Sankhya system that we learned some time back, we saw it emerge late in the Upanishads, in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. We see its seeds there, so it's really quite old. Remember, it has a non-Vedic origin. It comes from outside that camp. But it is taken up by every school of Vedanta. Shankaras, Ramanacharyas, Ramanuja, pardon me, and also was used by Buddha and is still being used today. So even when Ramanuja is distinguishing the world from the picture that Shankara painted, he's using the same vocabulary. So we're going to continue to use this. Now next week, we're going to take up Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And with that, we'll find that there's a strong marriage between Sankhya and Yoga. In fact, they're two of the schools of the six darshanas, the six great philosophies of India. So that'll be next week. We'll start on it. I may spend 2 weeks on it. We'll see. At least that's my intent at this point. So I want to take a moment tonight to say that we had a memorial service for our friend Jan Kleinman today. And I don't remember if I told you last time that Jan was a founding member of this center. That when we began the work here, Jan was with us. Jan was in the room when I was first introduced to Sri Aurobindo. I think she gave me green tea that night. Gave us all green tea, not me alone. And I said this to the group today, but I want to say it to all of you as well, that when she went to the ashram in 1969 and 70 with Bob Kleinman, her husband, who was a great philosopher, Mother found that she opened most readily to the emergence of the soul power of the psychic being. And it stood in front in her nature for much of her visit there. And where she went, Jan gladdened every life, every dwelling. When I was there a few years later, people were telling me how much they remembered Jan, that she was so beautiful and elegant in her movements. She was studying art, studying poetry, and everyone just loved her, just like they loved the mother. Because mother was like that too, you know. She just carried beauty with her. Whatever she did had such a charm and a grace, and Jan was like that. Some of you only knew her in these last years when she was on her decline. It's a pity. I wish you could have seen her. But I've got a PDF of a brochure and of a poster that I can share with you. And you can see some samples and photographs of what she appeared like in the past. Well, they're only emblematic of her physical beauty. She was beauty and spirit all the way deep. Yeah. So we celebrated Jan, and I celebrate her still. And Jan, if you're listening, we wish you a good journey and a good rest, and we'll catch up. Yes. So I want to read a poem that Jan's daughter Christina asked me to read at the memorial service. I'm going to read this poem until I get it right. Not tonight. I won't plague you with more than one reading. It's by E.E. Cummings, and the title will be obvious. I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. I am never without it. Anywhere I go, you go, my dear. And whatever is done by only me is your doing, my darling. I fear no fate, for you are my fate, my sweet. I want no world, for beautiful, you are my world, my true. And it's you are whatever a moon has always meant, and whatever a sun will always sing is you. Here is the deepest secret nobody knows. Here is the root of the root and the bud of the bud, and the sky of the sky of a tree called life, which grows higher than soul can hope or mind can hide. And this is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart. I carry your heart. I carry it in my heart. If you have any questions or comments.